Arthur Guterman penned these words. First, dentistry was painless. Then bicycles were chainless, and carriages were horseless, and many laws enforceless. Next, cookery was fireless, telegraphy wireless, cigars were nicotineless, and coffee caffeineless. Soon, oranges were seedless, the putting green was weedless, the college boy hatless, the proper diet fatless. Now, motor roads are dustless, the latest steel is rustless, our tennis courts are sodless, our new religion godless. It might interest you to know that he wrote these words in 1936. If we can learn anything from this poem, it would tell us that over time, the comforts for mankind have certainly changed, but not the heart of mankind. In fact, the Bible has made it very clear that as humanity rushes onward toward its final destination and appointment with the judgment of God, that mankind will become worse and worse. The old King James renders it, man will wax worse and worse. The truth is, Satan is not really very original. He is very clever, but what he does is take the same old lies and repackage them attractively for every new generation. And every generation has to deal with the lies, the deception, and the destruction that Satan will bring along. I happened to get a magazine in the mail that I subscribe to called Christian History, and I thought it was really fascinating that they have included a few letters that came from the time of Paul. This was going on during Paul's day, and I found it fascinating to read a couple of these letters that archaeologists have actually uncovered that are extant. And here's a letter detailing a mystical experience that a man had with the god Asclepius. That god, I had to go do some checking, was considered by the Greeks to be the god of healing. Here's this man's record of his experience. He writes, "There was a feeling as if I were taking hold of him and clearly perceiving that he himself had come. Of being midway between sleeping and waking, of wanting to look, of struggling against him departing. My hair stood on end," he said. "My tears flowed in joy. The burden of understanding seemed light. What man is able to put these things into words?" Interesting. The first century, a man has a mystical experience with a God who does not exist. And he literally feels that experience. Here's another letter written from a man to his wife who was evidently pregnant and very due. Here's how he writes, "Know that we are still in Alexandria. Do not be anxious. I beg and entreat you, take care of the little one, and as soon as we receive our pay, I will send it up to you. If by chance you deliver the child, if it is a boy, let him live. If it is a girl, cast her out." I find it very fascinating that the Apostle Paul, when he wrote the epistles, did not pepper the epistles with stories of these latest atrocities. As wicked and diabolical as Paul's day was, as we read here, you will not find one shred of New Testament evidence that the church is ever encouraged to stop everything and panic. Or for that matter, rewrite its primary function on planet Earth, to make disciples. That has not changed. Frankly, a great majority of our church today seems preoccupied with the darkness. Preoccupied with the latest atrocity of depravity that hits the American scene. I'm afraid that our preoccupation with the problem becomes part of the problem. I know in our culture we are surrounded by the ecologists and the feminists and the liberal strategists and the egotists and on and on and on. But the church is called, while it is called to pray, is not called to panic. It is called to penetrate, to permeate, by shedding the light in a dark world. Has it ever occurred to you that a lighthouse never once got rid of a storm? It merely stood and shone with such brilliance that the darkness was penetrated with the light. There wasn't anything more needed in Paul's day than the light. In Elijah's day than the light. David said, "Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my pathway." Why do we seem so shocked and put out that a world without the light would stumble along their path? Our mission is very simple. You know, we have in our neighborhood a few weeks ago this experience where the lights just all of a sudden, the power went dead. I don't know why it is my neighborhood gets this about once every 3 months. You hear this kapow off in the distance and then pew, everything shuts down. Now, it would be useless for me to gather my family and my kids and my close friends in the living room there and curse the darkness. It would be rather foolish for me to simply do nothing but rail against CPNL and maybe even start a little study group on the evils of the power organizations of our day and their failings. No, what I need to do is light a candle. It is not enough to curse the darkness. We need to introduce the light. We need candles for God's kingdom. Now, if there was ever a day in the world when it seemed that Satan, the prince of darkness, had gained the upper hand, it was in the days of Elijah. Take your Bibles and go back to 1 Kings 16. You remember, if our study included you last Lord's Day, that this was a generation of child sacrificers. A day of idolatry, a day of unspeakable deviancy and perversion that was even justified by means of religion. This was the day. And while Jezebel was personally paying the salaries for 450 prophets of Baal, Obadiah, the prophet in Elijah's day, had already compromised his stand, and he was hiding 100 true prophets of God away in caves. If you were there observing the scene, you might come to the conclusion that the score was Baal 450 to Yahweh 0. In fact, you might think the game is already over and you need to pack your gear and leave the stadium, or at least start cheering for the other side. It looked rather hopeless. The nation is experiencing rainfall. Bumper crops are their lot. Maybe Baal is the rider on the clouds. Maybe he is the provider. Maybe we ought to bow before his mistress Asherah and worship Mother Earth. Oh no. It's time for a little light. It's time for a word from God, from the lips of a messenger from God. Now, in chapter 17, we looked at just a few phrases there last Sunday. The days of Israel were the darkest ever known. Suddenly this man, this crude, uncultured man, walks into the palace, confidently up the stairs without any invitation. He makes his way past the guards into the royal palace. And he makes an announcement to those twin serpents of evil who are coiled on their thrones, ruling with great diabolical power. And he points his finger in their face, as it were, totally convinced that God is alive. And he says, in effect, Baal doesn't control the rain. Baal doesn't control the dew. The God of Israel, who is alive, is the rider on the clouds. He is the sustainer of life. You know, Elijah walks in not with a candle, more like a flamethrower as he introduces truth back into the courtroom. Now, James told us that he was an ordinary man. Now, I have just let that one statement just sift through my mind over these weeks. It's going to continue, and I want it to in yours, because although God used Elijah specifically for a rather miraculous age, and some unusual things will occur, Elijah was a man just like us. But the distinction was this. He had a word from God. And he was willing to light a candle for the kingdom. So he's speaking with the certainty that God is alive. Look at verse 1 again. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand. In other words, it didn't matter to him if the score was Baal 1,000,000 and Yahweh 0. He was convinced that Yahweh was permanently victorious, even though it seemed that Baal was temporarily the leading scorer. The game wasn't over. Now notice the last part of verse 1. Here's the word from God. There shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word. Elijah is in effect declaring, Baal doesn't control this, God controls this. I can just imagine a gasp emanating from those twin thrones. Those royal politicians who surrounded those twin serpents must have shuddered and then said, "Who is that man? Where did he come from? What right does he have to say what he's just said?" What a wonderful moment for truth. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall watching their shocked faces as Elijah introduced them back to the truth that they're worshiping dead gods and he worships a living God. What a brilliant light. Now, Elijah in the public arena was faithful. But for today, I want you to pack your gear and move with me to a barren place where God's second assignment for Elijah is in private. Look at verse 2. And this, by the way, is a more difficult assignment of the two. And the word of the Lord came to him saying, "Go away from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan." The Hebrew word "hide yourself" could be rendered or amplified to read, "purposefully absent yourself from view." This is assignment number 2. Elijah, "Yes, Lord, I've got another assignment. Ready. This will be a difficult one. Check. This will be a challenge to your personal faith. The engines are revved and roaring. Just name it. Go hide yourself by the brook." There seems to be a little static in the frequency, Lord. Let me check the antenna. Okay, it's all clear. What did you say? Go hide yourself from public view. That's what I thought you said. Lord, I've just begun my public ministry. And I'm sure you're aware of the fact that I'm the only one speaking for you. I made that up. Because as I tried to think the thoughts of this ordinary man, that would have been my response. "Lord, I just delivered such a smashing speech that the king and queen were left speechless. You saw it? The momentum's on our side. Let's take them out." No, God says, "I want to take you out and hide you away." You don't find one word of complaint or correction or argument from Elijah. In fact, look ahead at verse 5. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He just did it. Ladies and gentlemen, the mark of maturity here is not obeying whenever we might understand, but obeying when we might not understand. Elijah was doing a tremendous service for God in the public sector. And now God wants to pull him away into private isolation. Don't ever forget or overlook the fact that Elijah's public statement was rattling the kingdom. I mean, the ripple effect must have been incredible. The messengers were dispatched. "Hey, we have someone who will finally speak for the God of Israel. Alas, all of the evil of Ahab and Jezebel is going to be naught. We have a champion for God." Where'd he go? I think we forget a couple of truths. Let me suggest a couple to you. Number one, for those of you who serve God, for those of you in the public arena who are having enough courage to stand for Him, who have enough guts to pray over your lunch when people are watching, to have enough fortitude, and when someone asks you, "What did you do this past weekend?" you tell them you went to church, who are making headway with your candle shining brightly, it's easy to forget a couple of things. Number one, it's easy to forget that God is as interested in doing something in us as He is in doing something through us. We tend to forget, secondly, that God is as interested in developing our faith as He is in displaying His power. God could have cut off the rain without Elijah, you know. He could have spoken the word and the drought would have come. But God is always pleased to use ordinary run-of-the-mill people like you and me. And He allows us to co-labor with Him so that when it's all said and done, not only is God's work accomplished in the world, but His work is accomplished in our willing hearts as well. So God gives Elijah his assignment, then He provides the assurance. Look at verse 4. And it shall be that you shall drink of the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to provide for you there. Imagine that. Verse 5. So he went and did, exclamation point, according to the word of the Lord, for he went and lived. You ought to underline that word. Not visited. He lived there by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, Elijah will live there for 3.5 years. We like the first assignment. Lord, I'll serve you in the palace where the results are immediate. God says, Elijah, I want to see you in private. I want you to hide yourself from view. I want you to get to know me in the wilderness. Why would God pull somebody out of the limelight, the spotlight, God's only faithful voice in that generation? Why would He tuck him away out of everybody else's view but His? Why? Well, I very hesitantly want to suggest a couple of reasons why. I could be wrong, because the Word doesn't really tell us. But let me suggest a few. Number one, a period of isolation usually precedes, not always, but usually precedes, an entirely new ministry of involvement. Think of Moses, who was taken out of the courtroom of Egypt, sent to the backside of the desert where he languished for 40 years tending sheep. God was preparing him in the wilderness for his next assignment. Think of Joseph, who was abandoned and forgotten and neglected in a lonely Egyptian prison for years, ever, before he became prime minister. Think of Paul, who had a dramatic conversion. He should have hit the testimony circuit, but God immediately took him out, and he spent 3 years in Arabia. And we know absolutely little of those 3 years except that God was teaching him and preparing him in obscurity to be the greatest missionary who ever lived. There seems to be a pattern here. Perhaps the wilderness is the best place in all the world to get to know God. Second of all, while we would never volunteer for lonely obscurity, it is in secret where God's choicest work is accomplished. It's in the secret place where we learn the most about God's character. Third, faith is forged under private pressure. These three truths basically say the same thing. Isolation is preparation for something perhaps brand new. Now, God never gives His children a difficult assignment without providing an assurance. We have a book filled with them. But here's His spoken assurance to Elijah. He said in verse 4, I have commanded the ravens to provide for you there. Now in verse 6, and the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he would drink from the brook. Now, as I was studying this week, I asked the question, why would God use birds? Maybe you are not asking that question. You don't care why God might use birds. But I cared, so you're going to have to listen through this. Let me give you a couple of reasons. I think you'll find them helpful. Number one, to reveal to Elijah that he was in control of creation. Now, the liberal theologians don't like the miraculous element that ravens brought Elijah his breakfast and supper. I read a couple of them this past week as well, just for fun. They've suggested that the Hebrew word for raven, or avim, could be changed just a little bit to be rendered or translated Arabim. Arab. The Arabs fed him. Now, that's a slick way to tinker with the text, but frankly, it won't fly. I hoped you might enjoy that. I get strange thoughts in my study after looking at this for a long time. Frankly, and that would be a miracle, by the way, for an Arab to feed an Israelite. You know that. But that's not the miracle here. It's another miracle. Frankly, if God is powerful enough to create the universe, He is powerful enough to control the universe. He will reorder for 3.5 years the natural water cycle. He can also reorder the natural inclination or ways of a handful of birds. We all know birds don't cater meals to mankind. Birds don't bring food to humans. I know. I've got one. That little glutton has never brought me anything but grief. I'll give them to you if you'd like after the service, if we can slip them past my kids. If you can believe the first chapter of Genesis, you can believe the 17th chapter of the book of 1 Kings without any sweat. Every morning and every evening, Elijah received a meal from the beaks of birds. Now, James, you remember, said he was a man just like us. So as I bring that back into this moment, I just happen to wonder, could it be that between breakfast and supper, Elijah begins questioning God's provision? Could it be between that evening meal and that long, hot, lonely night by the brook, could Elijah have begun to doubt God's plan? If so, before his doubts could take root, here come the birds. Can you imagine? And every time they arrived, Elijah was reminded that God is bigger than Baal. That Baal doesn't ride on the clouds. God rides on the clouds. Now pay careful attention to what the birds brought Elijah. Don't want you to miss this. Meat and bread. Did you notice what the birds did not bring him? They did not bring him any vegetables. I think God's trying to say something to us. We need to apply this. Some of you nutritionists are out there saying, well, that may be so, but they also didn't bring him any glazed donuts. Well, that's a misapplication of the text. You let me apply it. Well, one more reason God may have chosen to use the ravens to deliver what I would call a model meal. Number two, God was reassuring Elijah that anyone he chose could serve as his messengers. Anyone or anything. You know, according to the book of Leviticus, the raven was an unclean bird. Dr. Gene Getz, who pastors, really provoked my thinking along this line. He suggested that should Elijah ever be tempted to doubt his worthiness for God's usefulness, the ravens would remind him 2 times a day that God can use common things to accomplish uncommon things. He can use a handful of birds. If he can do that, he can use me. So it was there by this brook that Elijah learned that God can use the weak and the insignificant to accomplish what he wants done. Jim Elliot, the the martyred missionary wrote, God delights in using nobodies who are willing to exalt somebody. I like that. Now notice verse 7. This is what I'm referring to as a severe answer. And it happened after a while that the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Now wait a second. There's hardly any food either. If God can perform a miracle in bringing food by the beaks of these ravens, surely He can allow this brook to continue flowing. And remember that Elijah has been living here now for nearly three and a half years before he receives this severe answer. He has lived there. I made mention of that as we read the text. That means he's probably built himself a crude hut, maybe put a few sticks together to make some furniture, and he's been camping out here beside this brook. God had already prepared his body that was toughened by his mountainous shepherding role. Now God is providing for his soul's development. But Elijah, imagine if you would with me, he's noticing all the trees and the shrubs and the bushes slowly dying away. He's feeling the swirling dust and the hot sand, and he has one arid day lead into another despondent day. Suddenly, could this be his imagination? But it seems that his brook is just a little smaller, not flowing as rapidly. Sure enough, he marks it, and over the course of the next few days, it's narrower. The shore is becoming hardened by the sun. And then his brook stops moving almost at all, and then eventually it's down to a trickle, and then the trickle trickles away. You need to understand that for Elijah, this place for 3.5 years has been a place of isolation and preparation, but now it becomes a place of desolation. You need to understand that Elijah is experiencing the answer to his own prayers. And it was a severe answer. Suffering would now become a part of God's process in preparing Elijah for the task ahead. You may wonder, as I wonder, as I have heard, mused aloud, why or how can a person be in the center of God's will and experience a dried up brook? I want to suggest a few truths, deep truths from the realm of desolation, where some of you may be even today. Truth number one, adversity or desolation enables us to understand the hurting world we are trying to reach. Isolation identified Elijah with God's power. Desolation identifies Elijah with Israel's pain. During the course of this isolation and preparation, it was a time of refreshment and communion with God. It was there that Elijah had branded upon his soul that God was sufficient. Now he is taught how Israel suffers. And that will prepare him for the nation as well. Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians how that we can, with the comfort we have received, be able to comfort others also. You know, there isn't anything more out of tune in the orchestra of God's family than for a believer to run around slapping, hurting people on the back, saying, come on, get with it! What kind of testimony are tears? There isn't anything more insensitive than a believer going up to somebody who's lost a job or their health or a mate or a child and slapping them on the back and saying, hey, brother, hey, sister, remember, all things work together for good. Don't you just want to slug them? Oh, my friend, God is as interested in your sorrow as He is in your triumph. He takes equal care with your tears as He does your joys. He understands. Never forget what I heard just or learned from reading just this past week. J. Oswald Sanders, I think, wrote the best book on leadership for our generation. And now is with the Lord. He was preaching a sermon in a church. He wrote about it. He said, I felt that I had done a rather commendable job. He said, I was leaving the building and overheard a conversation between two elderly women who were around the corner who didn't know he was there. One of the elderly women asked her friend, well, what'd you think about Brother Sanders' message? The other woman thought a minute and said, well, he was okay, but it'll be a lot better after he suffers a while. He never forgot that. Neither should we. And therein lies the purpose to some degree. Let me suggest a second one. Desolation or adversity is part of the curriculum for learning disciples. Practice during those confusing days, those challenging days when some of God's finest remodeling occurs in our souls. Then, by these dried up brooks. Maybe you're studying with me this morning and you're reading this passage and you kind of checked out. You've been talking to the Lord this whole 30 minutes because you've looked at this and you've seen your name all over it. But you came in here wondering why God has arranged for your voice to be silent. Why your gifts have been unrequested. Maybe you're wondering why your insight and experience has no avenue for effect in the body. Why your leadership seems to have been temporarily put on hold. Seems to be a point in your life where God has taken you to a small room and He has shut the door and He has pulled the shades and He has hidden you away in obscurity, in privacy. That's what's happening here. For several years, I have come to love the writing of David Roper, who writes on the brook Cherith with great application. I apologize for being lengthy in this paragraph, but I think you'll appreciate it. Listen as he writes. Cherith is synonymous with being disregarded, misunderstood, criticized, and accused. It is losing out as others take our place. Cherith is the death of our dreams. It's waiting in lonely isolation with hope deferred, without promised togetherness, and with no end of waiting in sight. Cherith is obscurity. It is dreary duty that no one sees or applauds. It is humdrum, tedious, boring, and sometimes distasteful. It is being unknown, uncelebrated, unnoticed, and unimportant. Cherith delivers us from the need for men's empty praise and makes us satisfied with God's well done alone. I like that. Cherith is learning to do without, without love, beauty, money, marriage, or health. It is being stripped of friends, father, mother, brother, money, reputation. It is being weaned away from all other passions but a passion for God. Cherith is going without feelings. It is learning persistence, not mere resignation, but a hearty obedience to a course we know to be right, regardless of how we feel. Cherith makes us thirsty for God. Slowly, steadily, God strips us of all our longings, leaving us with nothing but desire for Him alone, until we can say with Israel's poet, whom have I in heaven but Thee? There is nothing I desire beside You upon earth. Wow. Dear Christian, maybe I can suggest to you, from the authority of Elijah's biography, that you and I be willing to play God's version of hide and seek. With Him it is not a game. He is playing for keeps. If we will, like Elijah, obey the command to go and abide and live by that barren stream, and leave the answers to Him, then that place of hiding becomes a place of holiness, a place of intimacy and instruction. With the only one who understands, by the way. Your pastor doesn't understand. Your friends don't understand. Has it ever occurred to you that Jesus Christ began His ministry in the wilderness, where He alone took the onslaught of the accuser? Have you ever thought about the fact that He ended His ministry alone in the garden, praying under such pressure, His three closest friends failing to pray with Him, so that He sweat, as it were, great drops of blood? My friend, that suffering one understands. And He has a way to make something out of Elijah. He has a way with you. He has a way with me. And if we will be willing to live there, He will slowly turn desolation into restoration. He will take that lonely period and prepare you for something that right now you know nothing of. And frankly, may not even care of. You have found yourself this morning, as in the past, before a drying brook. Would you go to the Lord as His child right now, and maybe first of all, vocalize your permission to suffer, to experience pain. And then once saying or acknowledging that, remember and acknowledge to Him that that wilderness where you are is indeed the place where God is right now. He is not only the Lord of the mountaintop, He is the Lord of the valley. Would you thank Him for the assurance that He will never leave you nor forsake you?